record, and this is the case of Handgrove v. Ward, case number 81331. Mr. Breeden, would you like any rebuttal time as the appellant?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes? Okay, that will be the order. And feel free to proceed with your argument whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. This is Adam Breeden, appearing on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Lillian Hargrove. This appeal today presents several issues of law for which this court has not issued much guidance to the district courts in the past, particularly concerning informal agreements for child support between parties, between parents, and Nevada's retroactive child support statute. Most of the briefing involved in the appeal discusses NRS 125B030, which is the retroactive child support statute. However, I'd like to start today's argument by discussing NRS 126900, which this court has yet to comment on in any opinion of which I am aware. And this, of course, is a statute that allows the parties to come to informal child support agreements and to allow the court to enforce those agreements without any further consideration. And that statute refers to, quote, any promise in writing to furnish child support, end quote. The statute does not require, for example, a formal contract that is in writing and signed by both the parents. It doesn't contain any such requirements. And while members of this court or other attorneys or judges, if faced with this in their own personal lives, might choose to have some sort of formal agreement written down when child support matters are concerned, out in the real world, many parents don't do that. They choose to address matters less formally. And I think that what happened in this case is very typical of those informal agreements. We actually had the district court in this case refer to what happened as, quote, an obligation he had established, end quote, meaning an obligation of Mr. Ward to provide for financial support for his child. So it's puzzling that despite that finding that Mr. Ward took on that obligation, that the court would not enforce that under NRS 126900. We have written text messages that confirm that child support is being sought. We have an agreement of the father in text messages to provide that support. We have banking records showing what the level of support was over a period of time. In contract law, we would refer to that as part performance. And I do think that contract law is at least partially applicable to what the statute refers to as a promise. Therefore, the easiest way to dispose of this appeal is to say, look, it appears that there was a enforceable, informal agreement for child support that the district court did not enforce when it should have under NRS 126900. If the court is unwilling to find an informal promise between the parties, then it must analyze what the district court did under NRS 125B030. And that is the retroactive child support statute in Nevada. There are several issues of first impression that this appeal presents under that law. The first is, this court previously in dicta in the case of Mason versus Cuisinier said that this statute does appear to apply to unmarried parents as well as previously married parents. And I think some of the confusion there was that the statute uses the term that the parents are separated. And someone might say, oh, does that refer only to legal separation under Nevada law? And in Mason, the court said, no, this statute does appear to apply to unmarried couples as well. And that certainly is Hargrove's position here today, and we would ask the court to confirm that in any opinion. The second issue is one of the more heavily debated ones by the parties, which concerns whether a parent may initiate an action for retroactive child support for the period of time the child was a minor, but initiate that after the child has attained the age of majority. And the district court, in sort of a conclusory manner almost, seems to say, well, you have to file for that before the child maintains the age of majority. And that is simply not a requirement anywhere in the plain terms of the statute. One of the things that the district court did here was it extrapolated that requirement from Nevada's law that says child support ceases upon age 18 unless the child is handicapped or has special needs, in which case it can continue beyond age 18, but there must be a filing to seek that extended support while the child is still a minor. And the district court said, well, because of that, I think that there would be a similar requirement in 125B030. I disagree, and I think that sort of stands for the opposite, because we have a statute that says, hey, if there's a deadline to seek support, it is clearly stated in the special needs statute. There is no such similar deadline, or there is silence with 125B030. So I think it's very fair that if a parent, for whatever reason that parent might choose, delays seeking the support until maybe the child attains the age of 18 or 19, that they can still go back in time and seek the support that would have retroactively been awarded during the time the child was a minor. The third issue that I wanted to speak about today concerns NRS 126-161-3, and this was also used as a basis by the district court to deny retroactive support. And that statute simply says that in a paternity action, and this was filed as a paternity action, although clearly support was raised under 125B as well, but it simply says that if paternity is established and the child is still a minor, the court must make some sort of provision for child support. The district court and the appellee or the respondent interprets this as if the statute says only if the child is still a minor may a award of child support be entered. And it is the reading of the word only in the statute that we believe is error by the district court. We do not think that 126-161-3 speaks to how the court should award retroactive child support if the child has attained the age of 18 at all. The statute simply does not address that. It leaves the issue open, and therefore, presumably, that is simply covered by the general retroactive support statute of NRS 125B030. Fourth, we have the district court clearly stating that there is an equitable defense here that the mother, my client, Ms. Hargrove, should have sought some sort of formal support earlier. And what I would like to say is this court does have some jurisprudence, particularly from the Parkinson case, that there can be some equitable defenses to child support. But Parkinson's on its facts was much different than this case. That was an already established order in that case. And the mother in that case essentially said, I'm not going to allow you any contact with your child. You know, stay away from us. Under those unique facts, an equitable defense to not paying child support was found. That is absent in this case, and we see a history of Ms. Hargrove seeking support very desperately over a course of years in this particular matter. But I also want to impress on the court that your decision today not only affects the parties in this case, but potentially affects other litigants on this issue. And the reality is, all of us are not attorneys again. Many people do things informally. Many people, frankly, do not like the court system. They cannot afford an attorney. They prefer to handle things less formally. And many parents fear retribution, and that can be legal retribution. I'm going to go out and hire the best attorney in the world and just litigate to the end of the world against you, or it can even be physical retribution, like abuse from the other parent. So there are a lot of reasons why parents don't run out and immediately file these child support actions. So to look at one parent and simply say, in layman's terms, you snooze, you lose. I'm not going to award any support for you. It is inherently unfair, especially since we have 125B030, which is a decision made by the legislature after some consideration, that parents should be able to seek at least 4 years of retroactive support. In my final 2 minutes here, what I would say is that if this appeal presents an issue of what factors are to be applied by the district court when assessing whether an award of retroactive child support should be made at all. And you could probably easily go down to family court on any given day and find some cases where judges, district court judges, award the entire 4 years of retroactive support. You could find other cases where they award no retroactive support, such as this case. And you could find cases in between where maybe the district court goes back 1 year or 2 years. And the arbitrary manner in which it seems to be that the district court decides how far they should go back is very troubling. Yes.
Do you believe the parties had an enforceable contract? You believe there was a written contract as represented by the text messages? Because the court didn't seem to address that issue.
I do, and that was my initial point under NRS 126-900. And, of course, if this court found that there was an enforceable promise in writing, and we would say that this was confirmed in writing, written text messages of the parties, then you need not consider any of these other issues under 125B. And that is our first argument in this matter. To continue, I do think that some guidance from this court is needed for the district courts on the different factors that need to be considered. There's not even any requirement from this court yet that, for example, findings of fact and conclusions of law to support a denial or a grant of retroactive support be entered. And I'm coming to the end of my time now, so I'll merely close here by saying that neither law nor equity should have supported a result here where my client received no child support whatsoever in a case where clearly none was paid by the respondent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we'll hear now from Ms. Roberts.
Good morning. Amanda Roberts on behalf of the respondent, Thomas Ward. In this matter, contrary to what Mr. Breeden has said, Ms. Hargrove's complaint was actually for custody under 125C, not for paternity under 126. That's on the record on appeal 1 through 12. It's clear from what happened in the record on appeal that Judge Henderson made the choice, based upon the motion that Ms. Hargrove filed, to hear this as a paternity action instead of a custody action. And that's documented in the record on appeal. Under NRS 125C-0609, this was not a viable cause of action because at the time that it was filed, GW was emancipated and over the age of 18. There is no dispute in the record on appeal that GW was 19 when Ms. Hargrove filed her initial complaint. Then she again filed that motion under 126 seeking paternity.
Ms. Roberts, yes. As a practical matter, though, when does she have to file it? When he's 17 and 364 days, is that they have to file it? Your position would be they have to file it when GW is in the minority?
Well, under 125C, Your Honor, it specifically says at 125C-001 that it has to be as a minor, and 125C-0609 specifically defines child as a minor. So before he reached emancipation, she absolutely under 125C would have had to bring the claim. Under 126, Your Honor, there's a different statutory scheme. So under that scheme, she had to, in fact, 126 doesn't even apply here, specifically because 126.010, provides that under Chapter 126, you can only bring suit by a party for a man who is presumed to be the father under 126.051. Here, the record on appeal is very clear. Under 126.0531, he had already been determined by law to be the father because he signed that voluntary acknowledgement and declaration. He was on the child's birth certificate. He did not dispute it within 60 days. And essentially, the law specifically says, and I quote, the sign pursuant to this subsection is not required to be ratified by the court of this state before the declaration is deemed to have the same effect as a judgment or order of this court, determining the existence of the relationship of parent and child. Therefore, this is not a valid claim under 126 either because paternity had already been established, which is what the record on appeal asserts that we have argued to Judge Henderson. Ms. Hargrove argues to this court that that's just a small technicality that this court should overlook, but that's the whole point of the law. The legislature is very clear, and 125C and 126 are very distinguishable. Specifically, I've already stated to the law on 125 that states that it must be a minor child. And under 126, because of that declaration, Mr. Ward could not have a paternity action brought against him. Therefore, Your Honor, the claims that it's our position that she was barred from bringing the claims under either 125 or 126, and arguments that she should have been given deference by Judge Henderson in this court because she's a pro per litigant related to her initial filings and the error under 125C, the initial complaint being filed, just should not stand for this court. Specifically, yes, she filed as a pro per litigant. And if she had continued as a pro per litigant, then there may be some compelling reasons to do that. Except shortly after she filed, specifically May 30th of 2019, she had an attorney that made an appearance in this matter, according to the record on appeal. And that counsel never attempted to rectify the deficiencies in her pleading under 125C and 126. Therefore, the claim that they're making under 126.900 cannot be applied to this specific situation because paternity was already established. What she's essentially asking is that this court legislate from the bench and expand the timeframes or make more clear what is already clear from the legislature. In 125C, minor child is outlined and listed for the court with specificity. It is in language that is very easy for anyone to understand, and it is very clear under 125 or 126 what must be precluded or must be brought and when it must be brought.
I have a question, sorry.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
My question is, you're saying it's been established obviously by the birth certificate, but there had been no other court, they'd never been in court before. So,
correct.
You know, when you say paternity established or established of him being the father, that had never been in court, why wouldn't either section really apply? Because nobody had proclaimed one way or another that he was the father and he should be paying child support.
Because the legislature specifically tells us that it's automatic. If you look to 126.0531, it specifically says that voluntary acknowledgement that entered him onto the birth certificate, when he did not object to that, and I believe the period is 60 days, when he did not file an objection to that, it automatically receives the same effect, that's the exact quote, as a judgment or order of the court determining the existence of the relationship. So it's clear here that paternity had already been established. That was not disputed by Ms. Hargrove in the record on appeal. As it relates to that,
do you agree that there was a promise in writing to furnish support?
I do not, Your Honor. Okay. We outlined that in our brief to the court. We do not agree that there was a promise in writing, and I differentiated those specifically. If the court looks at those sections on the report in writing, it talks about a promise in writing. Mm-hmm. So that would be a promise that is done by Mr. Ward. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, well, I was just going to, you say a promise in writing. That's, the statute says any.
Promise,
uses the word
sorry.
Any and not a, which is a big difference. Because any is any. That means it could be, when you're saying in writing, you're just putting into this interpretation that it has to be a formal writing, in court, contract, whatever. But with the word any in front of it, any promise in writing can be any promise in writing, i.e. an email, a text, any.
But the way that this can be differentiated from the record on appeal, if the court specifically looks at the text messages, is Mr. Ward is not the one that made any statements regarding this alleged promise in writing. This is a statement that Ms. Hargrove made. It is completely contrary to what is in the record on appeal as it relates to those text messages. Mr. Ward did nothing as it relates to that. Ms. Hargrove made, in fact, she calls it an offer, and then she goes on to discuss it. It's not a promise in writing under any stretch of the imagination from my perspective, and it does not raise to the level of a contract. In fact, if we look at 125B050, it specifically talks about what's required when we get to this kind of writing, in my opinion, and that's specifically the period of limitations. 125B050 distinguishes pre-order and post-order, and that's very important for this court to take a look at. 125B0501 specifically indicates that if there is no support order, then a demand must be made during the minority of the child by specific means. And we outline in the brief those specific means. You must mail something. It must go to their address. There are specific things that must happen. And there's nothing that's disputed by Ms. Hargrove that she's taken those actions on the record on appeal. This is very specific, and it deals with when there's an order and when there's not. And there's no dispute here. There is no order. So when we look at 125B050, we then look to 2 and 3, and that relates to the period of limitations when there's an order. Here it specifically says under 1 that there must be a minor child, and that essentially tolls the statute of limitations. So in this child support statute, which is 125B, we have already a statute of limitation period that's very specific and tells litigants, whether with attorneys or improper person, what must happen for them to take action. In order to comply with 125B subsection 1, during GW's minority, Ms. Hargrove would have need to mail to my client's last known address, and that essentially tolls the running of the statute of limitations for her to bring an action for support. That is a direct quote from the statute. This language is very unambiguous. It's very clear. It is meant to apply to the entirety of 125B, which is the chapter relating to the claims that she's bringing for the four-year look-back period. So in this situation, because she did not do that, she's essentially again asking this court to legislate from the bench when there's a clear statute of limitation that's already applicable in this matter. If the court should determine that a contract does exist, which again we dispute, Judge Henderson found that there were payments, and this is on the record on appeal, from April of 2012 to April of 2013. There were no payments after April of 2013. So if we take the last possible date in the next month, that means it was May 31st of 2013. Because Ms. Hargrove claimed during her testimony on the record on appeal that they had a oral contract prior to 2013. So therefore, again, we go to the statute of limitations. Under NRS 11190 subsection 2C, an oral contract expires after 4 years from breach. Judge Henderson made a finding that the last payment was April of 2013. So therefore, we have to presume that May 31st of 2013 was the last possible date for this claim, and she would have had to bring it within 4 years, which was May 31st, 2017. Here, Ms. Hargrove did not file anything until March 12th of 2019. And therefore, based upon that failure to provide anything, we allege that if there is an oral contract, that she had not enforced it under the four-year provision, and there is no written contract. We then look at 125B030. If we look at the statutory language in this, we outlined for the court in our brief that this is a may, not a must. It is discretionary based upon the judge. They have not established in their briefing to this court why this court should overturn Judge Henderson's discretion as it relates to 125B030. Mr. Breeden talked to this court about in family court, you could go into any different courtroom on a different day and have one judge grant it for a year, deny it for a year. It's different, but it's based upon the facts and circumstances of the court and what is heard by Judge Henderson at the time that he ruled in this case. Moreover, Ms. Hargrove has essentially asked this court to establish that under 125B030, And at the time, the Nevada Administrative Code now applies to the statutory amounts, but it was 125B070. And so what she's saying is that it's essentially just a calculation of support. But 125B030 specifically talks about the costs of care, support, education, and maintenance. For her to recover, she would have had to establish what those costs of care, support, education, and maintenance were. And here, the record is completely silent as to what those expenses were for GW during his minority. So we've outlined for the court the claims that have been made and how they are not applicable to the facts and circumstances of this case. We outlined for the court all of the information that they're essentially asking this court to do by legislating from the bench rather than follow the clear and unambiguous law. We already have a statute of limitations under 125C. We have it under 125B, and we have it under 126. So therefore, there's no argument because it's clear and concise under the law. There's no ambiguity. And to change that would essentially be to a modification of the legislative intent. As it relates to the list of factors that they've asked this court to adopt, the list of factors are not necessary, and they're not needed from the court. The court has already given deference and direction, and they're asking this court to consider things outside of what the legislature has specifically outlined, which is care, support, education, and maintenance. If we had records on appeal of what Ms. Hargrove paid for care, support, education, and maintenance, then she might potentially be able to make this argument on appeal. But because the record lacks that, we don't believe that that's a viable option. The list of factors includes things that are not related to the financial situation, and it goes into detail about things that are not relevant in our position regarding what has gone on. Mr. Breeden has argued to you things about whether or not she was a victim of domestic violence or whether or not there's a delay in bringing a formal request. But the law is very specific on this, and Ms. Hargrove made the choice, and the record on appeal is clear. She specifically said on the record on appeal, it just wasn't, and let me give you the exact quote. I don't want to misstate her. She said that, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't know where it's at in the brief, that essentially it wasn't worth her time to move forward and seek the money from Mr. Ward.
No, so I'm sorry, say again?
That she essentially was not worth her time to continue to ask Mr. Ward for money for Gabriel. If the court wants the specific site, I can find it for you. And that's important to what's brought here and what's going on. As such, we're asking the court to affirm Judge Henderson's ruling at the district court level and not adopt the request that's made by Ms. Hargrove in this matter. Are there any other additional questions that I can answer?
Not in Carson
City?
Nope. Thank you so much.
We'll hear again from appellant on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. In my short time, I want to start by addressing Justice Stiglitz's questions about, is what happened here sufficient to be any promise in writing, which is the phrase the statute uses, NRS 126-900. Curious that statute doesn't use the term contract, doesn't require signatures, it doesn't require other formalities that we see, for example, like in real estate law, that maybe a notary or a witness be present. And I think the reality that was the basis of that statute is when you're out in the trenches representing folks in family law cases, these are people that are doing things by emails or text messages, the back of cocktail napkins, very informally. And that statute was passed so that the court could enforce those informal agreements that the parents at least at one time had agreed upon. So
about her argument that this was filed incorrectly under 126 and not 125?
You know, this is a notice pleading state. The client in this case was an improper person when she filed the complaint. She used a pre-printed court form. She selected the one most applicable to her case. It clearly requests a retroactive award of support, which would put 125B030 at issue. I think you might also be able to say that the parties tried some of those issues by consent as well. But I think that that argument from the respondent is very constricting and limiting as to how the court broadly reads complaints. And I don't think
and there was no issue. I mean, he never contested, obviously, at any point that he was the father to this child.
That is correct. And I think you're also correct in saying, though, that even if he had signed the birth certificate, I think a parent can still go to court and request a formal order declaring a parentage or paternity. And there are certain reasons why parents may choose to do that or not do that. We had some argument that no itemization of costs were presented, and the amount of retroactive support, if it's to be awarded, is the statutory amounts. I don't know of any requirement in any of this court's decision that, for example, to get awarded support, you actually have to produce an invoice or a statement showing that you provided monetary support for the child. With that, I see that my time is up, and if there are no further questions, I'll submit to the court.
Thank you both so much for your arguments. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate seeing both of you in person. Thank you again. This matter will stand submitted, and then we will be back on the record at 1 o'clock.